This is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Rihanna Pratchett, Jill Murray, and Kara Ellison. Rihanna is a game writer, narrative designer, comic book writer, and former journalist. She's written on such titles as Heavenly Sword, the Overlord series, Mirror's Edge, the Mirror's Edge comic series, the 2013 Tomb Raider reboot, the sequel Rise of the Tomb Raider, and the Tomb Raider The Beginning comic series. Jill has been a lead writer and narrative designer for games like Shadow of the Tomb Raider, Assassin's Creed Liberation, and Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry. She won a Writers Guild Award in 2013 and has published two young adult novels with the Random House of Canada. Currently, she is the narrative director for an unannounced indie project, as well as working on Boyfriend Dungeon with Kitfox Games and writing an episode of Later Daters for Bloom Digital. Kara is a former games journalist and current games writer, narrative designer, and screenwriter. She served as a narrative consultant on Dishonored 2, produced and designed for the TV show Last Commanders for CBBC, and is currently a narrative designer on Media Molecule's Dreams and Void Bastards by Blue Manchu Games.
That's right. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Rihanna, we'll start with you and get right into it. What is your writing process like?
I never know how to answer when people talk about a process. Because it's very simple. I just open a Word document and think very hard. And, you know, sometimes have a nap, sometimes do some reading, play with my cats, go back, look at it, think very hard again. There's no sort of secret formula to it. It's just thinking very hard until your brain starts to bleed out of your ears.
Do you have set hours you try to keep?
Vaguely. I work freelance and I have a terrible boss who lets me get away with all kinds of things. So I tend to be more of a night owl writer. Like I tend to do my best writing between about 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. And I generally spend most of the day from, I guess, about 9:30 or so doing other bits and pieces, and any kind of, if I'm really in the swing of writing, particularly if it's a big project, I'm able to start a lot earlier. But it's sort of just getting into the flow of something can be quite difficult, especially when you've got lots of things pulling your attention, like kind of emails or interviews or all the other kind of bits and pieces you end up doing as a freelancer. And because I work now a lot in other mediums as well, so I do a lot of screenplay writing. I do TV development as well. There's lots of different projects happening in different mediums, and so I'm sort of continually swapping between them.
When you're writing, are you doing like little bits of writing sprints, or is it one consistent? You're just sitting at the computer the entire time.
It really depends on the project, I guess. So at the moment, my main game project has been Lost Words Beyond the Page, which is a small indie game, and I've been just been working on the level scripts for that, and they're kind of more or less linear. They have a little bit of branching in them, but not much, and I just get sent a level brief and then sort of put the script together from that. So it's kind of as and when. It can be a bit difficult to predict when work is going to come in. It's a little bit with kind of screenplay work, it's a little bit more definite, and you have to kind of make your own hours and you know just work out how much you can do in a day when you're on a roll. So it kind of changes. I don't think I have a particular system for doing things. It's one of my New Year resolutions is to try and be more consistent in the hours I work, whereas I kind of tend to be all over the place. I get the work done. I should point that out. I always get the work done. I'm trained as a journalist. I have a healthy fear of deadlines.
Is everyone else here keep schedules like that, or are you even more loose?
No, I'm more of a morning person, and whatever I start working on first in the morning is the thing I'm likely to get the best work done on. So I have to shuffle things kind of according to deadline and need, because I also work freelance, and I know that my brain will just kind of stop working sometime around 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So I try to make sure I get working early so I can beat that 4 p.m. brain dead time.
How early in the morning are we talking?
I used to have a dog that would wake me up really early, and she unfortunately passed away in August. But since then, my sleep has been improving. Like, I actually do sleep now. So it's getting a little bit later, but it's still rare that I would start later than 9. I like a certain amount of activity around me when I work. So sometimes I'll go into a gameplay space, which is our gaming co-working space in my neighborhood. But often I'm working from home, so I'll just kind of wander over in pajamas with my coffee and get started a little before 9.
Awesome. What about you, Kara?
I mean, Jill's morning person routine sounds absolutely terrifying to me. Just like, no mornings, no. I think when Jill is like slowing down for the day, I am just like barely getting started.
This is why. See, I forget about time zones, and sometimes I will like send a message to Kara or Rihanna, or Kara and Rihanna, late in my day, and they're just those like, hey. I forget that they're like 5 hours or 6 hours ahead of me because they're both night people. It works out nicely.
Yeah, it's really handy for friends who are in the US or in Canada, because I'm always right. If they have ever got a question, I'm always like, hey, yeah, I'm there. It's actually like to like the 2 a.m. is the sweet spot for chatting with everyone. So around about 2 a.m. I'm like, well, I'm just finishing up work, so we may as well chat. But yeah, no, I mostly, I guess I, at Media Molecule, we have flexi hours, so I tend to trail in late, spend about half an hour getting a coffee and trying to look at an email, maybe, and then I get to work on whatever we got that day, which is usually, I guess, whatever emergency happens in the office. And then, I tend to just try to write late into the night. Like I technically speaking, my hours finish around about 8 or 9 if I trail in very late to the office. But usually I spend most of the evening at home writing as well. So voluntarily, I should add. But yeah, I tend to just like work really late just because I like it. And those are my hours. And I like to think, I might have said this before on Scriptblock, but I like to think that when everyone else is asleep, all the ideas are yours to take.
I wake up early, usually because I'm hungry. So it's not like some kind of like pious, Puritan work ethic thing. I'm just like, man, I really want to eat something.
But you want to get into a fist fight for the ideas, Jill, right? Like when I'm like stealing them from people, I'm stealing all the ideas from people when they're asleep, but you're just in a big fist fight in the morning. You're like, get out of my way.
No, there's no one up that early either. Like, I don't know if it's like this around the world, but certainly in Montreal, no one works on video games before 10 a.m. So if I'm starting at 8, it's like I have all of the brain space. I didn't realize we were, I thought there were too many ideas. I didn't know we were in competition for them.
That's what it feels like sometimes.
Well, there's lots of ideas. There's not very many good ones, I guess.
Oh, so it's like a Black Friday thing. Get right. The sale first.
Get the bargain.
Okay. Yeah.
We have to get up early regardless just because the sun is always out and you can never count on clouds blocking them in the morning.
Oh, you poor things.
What do people do in California, like, for small talk? Like, here in the UK, we're like, okay, let's talk about the weather. It's weird, again. It rained, like, 5 seconds ago, and now it's sunny. And then probably later, there'll be snow. So in California, they're just like, oh, it's, I see it's sunny again. And then what?
They talk about where to get the new like vegan food or the new paleo diet, or where to not vaccinate your kids.
Okay, I understand.
Or 2 months ago, a hurricane touched Los Angeles from the Pacific, and that just meant like an inch of rain hit LA. And for about 2 weeks after it, it was like you hear someone on the street going, crazy about that rain, right?
I love that this is how you think about talking about weather, that your story starts 2 months ago. Some weather happened.
It was a big thing. We've had rain since then.
We were so excited.
Yeah.
It's been raining for about a month in London, or it just feels like it. We're getting lots of special rain, and we're getting like named storm after named storm happening at the moment.
That sounds beautiful.
Montreal has had lots of rain and snow also. It's been spring-vember for 2 months.
Send it to us, please.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
People wearing t-shirts out right now.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Yeah. Gross.
Speaking of disgusting, let's talk about freelancing.
Oh, yeah.
Since all of you have worked as freelancers, do you have any advice for those out there doing it or wanting to do the same thing? Like how to find work or how to navigate contracts successfully or stuff to watch out for or anything?
Ooh.
I feel like I more and more understand two things about at least freelancing and narrative design, which is number one, if you aren't enjoying the job or it seems like it's impossible to do a good one, you should leave. Because there's always going to be another job. I know that sounds really, I mean, maybe that's, I guess if you're not really well known in the industry, that might not be true. But I feel like there's always another job that can keep you going until you find the right one. I don't know. For me anyway, I'm really glad that at some jobs, I kind of feel like I'm just not the right fit for this, or this is not going the way that I need it to. I have to leave. And I've been really lucky in the past couple of years with the jobs that I've got. But I think, I don't know, every so often I think to myself, oh, I should have left that job earlier because I wasn't really suited to it. So yeah, that's the first one. And the second one, I think for me at least, is know when not to take another job because it really takes its toll on you. If you work two jobs at the same time, make sure that you're not giving too much or that you're not overworking yourself. I feel like I'm in such a privileged position, but I also feel like I really need to make sure that I don't overwork myself. And that's become more of a concern recently. But those are the two that stick out to me.
Hmm. I would agree with everything Kara just said. As for getting into freelancing in the first place, it's actually a way that I've worked for most of my life because I was a web developer for 11 years before games. But I would say that I owe the fact that I'm able to freelance in games to having worked for large studios for a few years first and getting a few credits under my belt that way. I think a reason those jobs do keep coming, probably Kara, you probably do this without even noticing it, but is we do actually a lot of networking, which doesn't really mean showing up at an event and trying to sell yourself. It means you're constantly developing relationships that you meet with people all over the place without any real expectations of them. And then over time, you are part of a community and then the work keeps coming.
I think that's true. I mean, certainly I did a lot of that in the beginning. And obviously being a journalist really helped because I know everyone quite well. But yeah, like I don't have to do so much networking anymore. So I would agree with that. But people still contact me for jobs from things that I wrote like years and years ago.
Rihanna, do you have a comment? You just raised your hand.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with the journalism thing because I also started out as a journalist and I started out as freelance for a women's magazine called Minx. Very strangely, writing games reviews for a women's magazine was unheard of then and weirdly is still unheard of now, more or less. And I started out freelance because the editor just knew I was into games and I was already doing a few bits and pieces for her and they thought it might be fun to cover them for a bit. And then I ended up going to PC Zone full time for a couple of years, and that has been a bit of a hotbed of game writers, or it became so because I went into game writing. So did Mark Hill, so did Will Porter, and so did Martin Corder. And I think a lot of journalists have have made or are starting to make the transition. And it was wonderful for networking. I got my first few jobs because of contacts that I had from being a journalist. Like they weren't sort of huge and glamorous jobs, but they gave me experience and they paid the bills. And that was very important. And, you know, I absolutely agree with what Jill said about, you know, you're constantly kind of networking and making friends apart from anything else. Like I got work on Bioshock Infinite because of a friendship I'd made 10 years before with a friend of a friend. And we ended up going shooting guns at the LA gun range and eating steak afterwards, which was a very bonding experience. And then 10 years later, I got work on Bioshock Infinite. So yeah, you always kind of just building friendships and networking and kind of getting yourself out there and networking with other writers as well, because a number of gigs I've got, particularly the Overlord ones, have come to me because they approached another writer and they felt it wasn't for them and they recommended me, or someone I worked for before recommended me. So networking with your peers as well as the people that can directly give you work is also very useful.
Yeah, I think sometimes people, especially newer writers, have a tendency to act like they're in competition with all the other game writers. And then the reality seems to be that there is a lot of work and people get busy and then need someone else to do the jobs that they can't do. So more often than not, I think we help each other out.
I think so too. And I also tend to send jobs to other writers if we need another writer on board and I trust them and I've worked with them before. I tend to try to be like, oh, you know who would be really good at this? This person. I know them well. You know, I like working with them. I like their stuff. Like maybe we should work together with this person. And unfortunately, like I haven't had like much of a writer's room experience. It's usually always like me on my own, but I always get really excited about the prospect of that. So I think it's kind of weird when you encounter someone who's a little bit hostile because they feel like they're in competition with you. Cause it's really such a lonely job most of the time that you're really happy to just like have someone else to talk to about it and maybe write with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to backtrack a bit to networking. How would you do networking well, like giving advice to someone who doesn't do a lot of versus getting into the industry? And maybe it's better to say like what not to do.
Oh, well, sure. I look at it on kind of like a 7-year scale. like I'm meeting people and maybe one day we'll work together or maybe we won't. And so all that work stuff isn't really that important when you first meet. The way not to network, I have a number one way not to network. And that is like, if you go to see a panel of game writers talk about game writing and it's, for example, maybe an organization like Pixels has hosted it. So it's an organization to encourage women to make games and it's a panel directed at women. And you are like one of the guys who got one of the tickets for guys, do not come up to me afterwards, like monopolize all of the question time and then hand me your card and try to get work ahead of all the women that showed up. That would be an example of what not to do. Like, be cool. Approach people like they're people. And like, be aware of your surroundings and what the space is for.
It is insane how many times we've seen aspiring writers, developers think of networking as a transaction where, hi, I've said hi to you now. Here's my business card. Now give me yours. And that's it.
Yeah. Like the jobs that I have, they came from meeting people. Like the best thing I've ever worked on, probably. I'm working with a guy that I met at a client party like 4 years ago at GDC. And I was just like standing around being obnoxious, making stupid jokes, being way too honest about how I feel about different things in games in the industry. And he was just like, you're kind of hilarious that you'll just say these things out loud. And we kept in touch for a few years and now we're working together. And I never had any expectation because like the games he was making at the time were like fighting games, which I am not interested in. But everything changes really fast.
Yeah.
So you never know. You have to just make connections with people based on the fact that you actually like them and are interested in what they're doing and care about them as people.
Yeah, I think social skills are majorly underrated in video games. Well, maybe they're underrated by other people, but not by me. I think especially in Media Molecule, we look for people who are really, really good to work with and are really personable and really try to do their best to make other people feel comfortable. And I don't know, I just feel like there's there should be a real emphasis on that, because it's much easier to raise your standards of writing, I would say, than it is to raise your standards of sociability and raise your standards of, being personable. Like, that's something that you have to learn over a long period of time. But you can always improve your writing skills just by, you know, maybe getting some mentorship or like doing a course. Or for me, it's just like the beginning of a project learning curve can be quite steep. So sometimes I'm not as good at the beginning as I am when I know where what all the details are and like all of the constraints. So I don't know. I think some studios would put less of an emphasis on that, but I would say that it's really, really important to, if you're networking, don't look at it as being transactional. Look at it as being like, get to know these people and just be personable and nice and like funny and interested and understand what boundaries are, and you'll be way more likely to get a job.
I would argue that you can improve your writing by improving your social skills. Like, what is writing if it isn't having a curiosity for other people?
Yeah.
Rihanna, do you have anything else to say?
No, definitely agree with the others. And also, when approaching writers, kind of be aware of how they work, in that I'm always asked if people can be my intern, and it's just like, I work from my bed. Like, I think it's going to be hugely inappropriate at best, really, because you'll just be, it'll just be very awkward. You'll just be sitting at the end of the bed like a gnome, watching me type. And it's just like, but I do often get asked for people to intern with me, which is strange. And I also wanted to kind of go back to a little bit to the getting work question and add something onto there. I have an agent, and I do sometimes get game inquiries through him as well. And I know agents are, they're still very new for games. I think they're a little bit more prevalent in the US. I know that there was Sidelines used to be an agency for writers in the UK. I think there is another one, Cara. I don't know whether you're in it or you know of it.
Yeah, I'm represented by an agency here. They do send me quite a lot of work, but I often have to turn it down because I already got something else to do. So, but they do send me like a lot of work, and I generally just don't have time these days because I'm doing Dreams full time. But yeah, I think in general, it's really good if you can get an agent, because they do tend to like be kind of this centralized force that everyone goes to ask.
Yeah, and what's interesting is I sort of taught him how to be a games agent a little bit. So he was a film and TV agent, and I came to him because of a film project I had, and then sort of I talked to him about games and maybe how game contracts differ from kind of film and TV, and maybe in some places how we can make them a little bit more similar, you know, pushing for things like signing bonuses or kind of bonus on sales or something like that, which he's been very helpful with. And I think they're actually pitching some of the other writers in the agency who don't come from games but have an interest in games as kind of game writers, and they're sort of broadening, without being official about it, just broadening out their involvement in games, even though that they're that's not their mainstay. And that's quite good to have that kind of representation behind me, and it gives me a lot of confidence, and they are the ones that go through the contracts and, you know, every kind of legal facet, and they're the ones that hassle if I haven't been paid, and that's a big weight off my mind.
That's super interesting. I haven't found agents to be very common in North America, but maybe that's just me. Max and Nick, you would have a good idea of what things look like in the US.
There are no game agencies in the U.S. If there are, it's like...
The Writers Guild is very confused by them.
Yeah. The Writers Guild, at least for the U.K., seems like they support game writers more because they actually publish the yearly like average salaries for game writers. But the Guild in the U.S. does nothing. They have a game writers caucus that is whatever. I will not... I'm not going to talk about it, but
they're disappointing to deal with.
Yeah. I think that's Tom Bissell might be with CAA. I'm not sure about that claim, but
he does
movie stuff.
And that would be a special case. It's not like there's someone you can approach there and just be like, hey, I'm a game writer. Can you represent me? I used to have an agent for YA fiction before I fully devoted myself to games, but... It would be nice to have someone to do all of that negotiating, because what tends to happen is, you know, you go to take a contract and you have to deal with either HR or an outsourcing rep. And the way you have to negotiate for yourself can affect the way your working relationship goes. I had one studio. This was when I was still trying to be an employee before I realized I had to get out. I had one studio tell me that the fact that I negotiated my salary meant that I wasn't a team player. And that's just not true. But I do think it's extra dicey for women, because you have to fight harder to make sure that you are acknowledged for what you're worth. But the fact that you're willing to do that gives you kind of a permanent reputation for being unlikable.
Yeah, it is really difficult. I had similar situations myself, so yeah.
Yeah, so it would be super great to have someone do that for me.
I think in regards to game agencies, I don't know one that just specializes in games, but certainly some of the bigger agencies used to have game wings. Like I know William Morris at one point, before they merged with Endeavor, used to have a game writing wing. And I know that there are American game writers that are represented by agencies. Now, whether they're all doing games and other things as well, but I know at one point some of the big agencies did have game writing wings and represented game writers. But there's just nothing sort of centralized in the way that Cara's One is or Sidelines was.
Yeah.
And the year that I won that Writers Guild Award, I was approached by a few agents who were like, oh, if you want to start writing TV or movies instead, then we might be interested in representing you. But I really only want to work in games. Like, I'm in the right space already.
It's funny because Rihanna mentioned that people ask her if they could be her intern. And like, I had dinner with Rihanna like a couple of months ago or something and asked if she would be my mentor for movies. So sorry, Rihanna.
No, that's fine. You weren't sort of asking to come and live at the end of my bed, effectively. So,
Can I?
It's a big bed. You'll have to move over a couple of cats, but you know.
This gives me like the most amazing mental image from that scene in A Tale of Two Cities, when like the guy comes in to elaborately make hot chocolate at the bedside to sort of illustrate the decadence of the era. You could like reenact that scene, but in like London in 2019 with a bunch of cats and Kara making hot chocolate.
I did used to work in a publishing house, and the first job they had me do was learn how to steam milk and make espresso for coffee. So I can do that elaborate system if you would like.
That's certainly a point in your favor, Cara. I'll consult the cats and get back to you.
Okay.
We're half hour in. I just realized that we fucked up and did not ask the second and third question on our list, which was asking what Jill and Cara have been up to since the last time they came on this podcast.
Oh, okay.
Oh, God. You first, Jill.
Sure. I guess the last time I talked to you was kind of in the first time that I was doing indie stuff.
Yeah.
So I did indie stuff, and that was great. And then I was invited to kind of come on board as lead writer for Shadow of the Tomb Raider kind of in their last year of production. So I did that, and we shipped it in September. And I also got to do the press tour for that, which was cool. And then I've gone back into indie. I'm feeling super Canadian right now. I'm working, I wish I could tell you more about what it is, but it's not announced yet, but it's like my favorite thing ever. And I'm just working with this delightful team that's mostly based in Toronto. And the game is sort of heartfelt and silly. And we get to create a lot of it just by teasing each other and being ridiculous. And I'll have to come on a third time to tell you about it when it's announced.
Yeah.
And then I'm doing some, I previously worked on a game called Long Story, which was a dating sim for teens that was like really inclusive and awesome. And so that company, Bloom, is going to be making a new game that's also a dating sim set in a senior's residence. And it's called Later Daters.
Oh,
wow. Good title.
I get to write a very special episode. I don't want to say too much about it, but it kind of like is about some weird stuff that happens after everyone eats too much five cheese macaroni and cheese and has really interesting cheese mares. And I don't know if I can talk about the third thing I'm doing, but I am doing like some editing and extra work for Boyfriend Dungeon from Kit Fox Games.
Rad.
Awesome. It's like one of my favorite companies and friends here in Montreal. And then I'm pitching some cool stuff with some cool people that I definitely can't talk about, but it's rad and awesome, and I hope that it comes true. And then I'm also trying to convince the first team I talked about to make my own next project. So we'll see if I can persuade them by the time we're done making this game.
This all sounds great.
It sounds so good. I'm getting such a restless feel listening to you be like, I'm going to try and do a project of my own. I'm like, oh my God, I want to do that.
Well, I'm constantly trying to do a project of my own, but I always have a lot of ideas and I'm not always in the mood for one or the other of my own ideas. I'm a bit like a cat. Like, I want to be on the other side of the door, whichever the side of the door that I'm on.
I know. I talked to Steve Gaynor and Carla Zumanja a lot, and they're always like, actually, like, be careful what you wish for, because when the game's yours, all you do is like have horrible nightmares about it going wrong.
Ugh. That's kind of why I want this one team to make it, because I like their ideas and I'd be happy with them taking it in their own directions. I think it would enable me to let go of it a little bit. Right. So hopefully they're listening and are charmed by this idea.
What about you, Kara?
I can't remember. Was I working on Dreams last time I talked with you? I think I was.
No. This was like December 2016.
Oh, was it? Oh, Jesus. So, I've been working on Dreams for a really long time. I guess it's like almost, yeah, it's like 2 years now, I guess. And obviously everyone who's been working on Dreams before me has been working on it for much, much longer. It's been a really long time. It's been like at least 6 years, I would say, or more. I don't know that it's been, the project's been ongoing, but, hopefully have something nice to say soon about that. But I have been working on Dreams, and I have been working. So I worked for Blue Manchu on Void Bastards, which was like kind of like a match made in heaven, I guess, because it's like a kind of almost Douglas Adams-y. Like they briefed me on what they wanted, and I felt like I had been blessed by the game writing fairy. Mm-hmm. Like I just felt like an angel had come down and then touched me on the forehead. Because they said, we're kind of thinking like, have you ever read the Red Dwarf novels, like the books? And I was like, they're like way darker than the comedy. And they were like, that's what we want from you. We want that. Can you give us that? And I was like, yes, I can give you that. And then they were like, here's our reference material. Terry Gilliam's Brazil. And how about a little bit of Douglas Adams? And I was like, yes, yes, let's do it. So I did, I went deeper into Brazil and I looked at kind of like this spiraling into awfulness British bureaucracy, like a dystopia that's entirely like a Theresa May governmental fuck up, right? And can I say fuck?
Yes, you can.
Oh, good. Okay. And so, yeah, so there's this like horrible sort of spiraling dystopia that's more like a kind of polite British colonial nightmare where, you know, it's like a lot of British colonialism is kind of covered up by politeness and like respectability politics and like, oh, if you don't ask for it nicely, you won't get it sort of thing. Meanwhile, you know, blood, massacre, etc. So there's a lot of that in there where there's a lot of kind of almost like 2000 AD style horrible British future where everything is extremely cynical. But at the same time, it's quite funny, and they allowed me to write a lot of dialogue for like monsters and stuff that was extremely silly. So it was, it's been really wonderful, and obviously it looks, White Bastards is like beautiful. Ben was an animator on Ren and Stimpy, so it's a like a Ren and Stimpy-esque almost like kind of this kind of 3D cartoon universe that looked really beautiful and grungy. So yeah, that was so much fun to work on, and technically I'm still polishing up bits and pieces, but they were just like a dream to work with, and everything that they were looking at doing was really interesting. Like, it's kind of like FTL, but it's like 3D, and you know, the development director on like System Shock 2 and BioShock, like that's just a dream game, and everyone on it was so, is so talented. And yeah, it was such a great thing to work on. So that's going to come out soon. There's other stuff I'm working on, but they're total secrets and I can never talk about them on pain of death.
So Rihanna, you coined the phrase narrative paramedic, which is when a games writer is put onto a project relatively late in the development cycle and is tasked with patching up as many holes as possible.
AKA my entire life.
Like, this is a role I think everyone here has performed at some point or is at least familiar with. So I want to ask if anyone has any advice or tips for how to do this well.
I think it's about establishing the parameters, the boundaries that you have to work with. Like, what is there and what needs changing? You know, how much time you've got to do it, establishing the limitations, and they can, like, there's no kind of set kind of pattern of what it's going to be like. You'll just get a kind of, I don't really take these gigs on anymore, so, but I do know that they exist. But you know, something like Mirror's Edge, for example, was a bit of a narrative paramedic gig, although certainly not by no means the worst I've heard. But with that, everything had been designed with no narrative in mind. So it hadn't necessarily all been built, but I'm not even sure she had a name. The game didn't have a name. The visuals for the world had been established, but no one had thought about why. The movement of the game, the parkouring, had been established, but no one thought about why this character that had no character was doing this thing in this city that had no background or story or history to it. And so I had to kind of establish, okay, these are the assets I've got to kind of wind a story around. There are these visuals, it's this type of movement, this is the character. I've got to go backwards in terms of how I work in any other medium and wind a narrative around existing assets. So it's all about establishing what you've got to work with and the kind of limited space you've got to work within. And sometimes that can actually make you very creative. Sometimes limited spaces can do that. And it's often, sometimes it can be quite fun to work in limited spaces. They can be more fun sometimes in the blank page. Not that I necessarily recommend giving writers lots of limited spaces, but now and again, it can be quite an interesting challenge. And I think they work well for mid-level and established games writers who can hit the ground running, who know the questions to ask and kind of know the parameters and can just go for it. I think it's a lot harder when you're first starting out, although it may be the kind of gigs that you're offered because you just don't know as much about, you know, how the sausage is made. And so, and I think those sort of things can put you off very easily as well. So yeah, just ask lots of questions.
I don't know if this is like relevant too much, but like I read this article recently about how often in periods of crisis, women or marginalized people are often put in the pivotal role to see if they can get the white men out of it. And when you look at a lot of like paramedic type jobs for companies and stuff, people are, especially women, are like put in these positions where they have to pick up the pieces a lot. And I always think about mm-hmm. that, and I like make myself kind of a bit wary of like if it's at the end of a project and then people are like,
yeah.
Hey, can you come in and clean this up? It's like, God, it's like that History Boys quotation where it's like, women's job in history is to follow men around with a bucket. I just always think about that. But yeah, I definitely agree that you have to kind of establish, I think you have to establish like what they can't change, what they absolutely cannot change because they don't have the budget or time, and then work around that and then figure out whether it's even possible to make a story out of the stuff that they've got left. And that can be quite hard to figure out, I think. But once you've got that, it might be possible. It really depends on what it is.
For CEOs, the phenomenon Kara is describing is known as the glass cliff. And it's basically God. That a disproportionate number of women CEOs are people who are brought in during a time of crisis to fix a problem. So if they fail, then it's like, oh, well, she was never suited for the job, and they can get them out of there quickly. If they succeed, it's like, oh, well, we need a different person to lead us through prosperity. And they tend to lose the job that way.
Oh, God.
I do definitely see a similarity with being brought in at the end projects to steer them back on course narratively. And I find that if you can do that work, you'll never go hungry. But it's a really socially difficult role because you're stuck in this position where on the one hand, people are very like, oh, my God, thank you for showing up and helping us fix this thing that's impossible to fix. And on the other hand, they're like, who are you to come in at the end and change the meaning of the story and become the person who is qualified to talk about it when the rest of this development team has been working for 3 years? Like, who do you think you are?
Yeah.
So you tend not to find inclusion in teams that way. Like you're going to end up remaining temporary because there's so much that needs to be done so quickly. You have to act decisively. You have to push for your point of view. Otherwise, things are going to not get done in time. It's not like arriving in pre-production and you get to plan everything. It's like you have to do pre-production work in late production, knowing that the thing has to ship really soon. So, and you don't have time to establish relationships before you start doing that work. So I think it kind of predisposes you to bouncing around from project to project.
Yeah.
And for me, I've often felt like, man, I wish I could find a team that was like my home. And when am I going to do that? I think I have that now, luckily, but it's taken a long time to get here.
Yeah, I mean, Media Molecule is quite cushioned from that sort of thing generally because parity is quite good. Like we're at about 40% now parity.
Wow.
And that's pretty good for video games. And that's because our studio director, Siobhan Reddy, is really aware of that percentage and is constantly trying to make it better. But yeah, MM's pretty good at that. So I do feel like I have a lot of colleagues who are women, so I never feel totally alone in any room. In fact, a lot of the time I feel actually surrounded by women who are very supportive of each other. And my male colleagues are incredibly supportive too. So generally speaking, we have a really good atmosphere to produce stories. But yeah, like I think it's a tough job, the paramedic job. And I definitely prefer to go, I guess, the way that Rhee has gone, which is that, and you have gone, Jill, where is like you kind of drift into jobs where you get to do the pre-production in plenty of time, and you can scope it out, and you know exactly what you're doing from the beginning. because that is like actually the meatiest part of story is the planning mm-hmm. and the making that make sure all your characters have good arcs and trying to give the game depth is actually a structural thing. It's, I think a lot of people think that writers are people who just do the lines, and I think people are really kidding themselves if they think that that's what our job is, because like Rihanna was trying to point out, like if you make an entire game without thinking what the visuals actually mean, then you're going to have a humongous job trying to pick that up into a story.
And I also think that it is a hang up from the days when everyone or anyone did the writing, anyone who had that kind of timing and inclination did the writing. And so there's still a little bit of a hang up that anyone can do the writing. So, you know, the word bits can just be, they'll be slotted in later. We'll leave a space for the word bits. And, you know, professional writers just working in games or just specializing in narrative weren't really a thing. So I still think we've got a throwback to those days. And, you know, it's so important to build what I call the body of the iceberg, which is under the surface and it will be invisible to the player for most of the time, because you've got to build that to make the tip of the iceberg, which is what the player experiences in the game, that much more stronger, that much more meaningful. But that building of the iceberg takes time to do. And although the writing is kind of technically cheap in that it's, you know, it's easier to kind of change a word on a page than many other things involved in game development, but it, you know, narrative is the glue that holds all the expensive things together. Therefore, it needs to be developed a lot at the same time, or it just nothing will be as strong.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, I remember when working on Assassin's Creed 4 with Darby McDevitt, who was the lead writer for that, like sharing a moment of frustration and then kind of doing the math and coming up with the figures that, like, people think that writing is just when you're writing, but really writing is like the 13 months of meetings and then the 1 month of writing. And that's where your game comes from.
Yeah.
In a panic, writing really fast.
Yeah, like you're staying up all night going, I need to do this in like one line and it has to do four things. And you're just like,
exactly.
Yeah.
And that all comes together really quickly once you've done your planning right. But you do need like a good 13 months of just talking to people to get it all sorted out.
Yeah, I think for me as well, it's like actually pitching to level designers and artists how the story should play into their area and like how I can move them into thinking that to go alongside the story is a fantastically great idea, because if they at any point veer off into some wild unknown, then you have to compensate for it. So, and then you have to end up making the excuses for it. And so a lot of the time I end up sort of working with my colleagues and going, okay, so here's what I thought was a good idea for the story because it solves all of these problems for us. So if we do it this way, then the player will feel this way and that will flow into the next level we have. And I constantly do stuff like that where I'm like, I think this might be a good idea. Can I get you on board? Because like, I think it will make all of our lives a bit easier. And I do a lot of that, and working with the audio department especially is really, really important. I think I do most of my work at MM with the audio department, asking them how they can pick up the slack of the story and how they can make us feel more involved and stuff. And like, luckily they're so like excited by like everything that we're doing in the game that they always come through. So it's really cool just to get that role of, it's like mediator, I guess. Like I keep saying, I feel like an administrator of meaning in games. Cause like, I don't know, narrative design doesn't, it sounds like too important for what I do. What I do is like, I'm kind of like a go-between or like a, I don't know, like I do feel a little bit like people use me as a chess piece or something, but I have a little bit more agency than that.
Don't undervalue the people skills aspect of the job.
Yeah, it's really hard to get
that. It's still design, it's still diplomacy, it's still strategy, and it's leadership.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, your choice is become a good narrative leader, or you will end up having to be a narrative apologist.
Right. And like, I keep thinking to myself, like a lot of my role is figuring out when to let something go and when to push back on it. And that's one of the hardest skills I think I've had to learn as a narrative designer, is when to say, actually, I think this will be a problem further down the line. And if we don't do something about it now, it's going to get really bad. And knowing when to say that and make an absolute nuisance of yourself is really hard.
And you'll also have so many battles that you could potentially fight. So you kind of have to save your strength for the ones that are going to be most meaningful, or are going to make most impact, because you will just burn yourself out fighting everyone.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And it's knowing exactly how to pitch that and how to essentially make people feel like you're still in control and they're still in control, but also make them feel like they're confident that the thing that you're suggesting will work. Yeah, it's a really difficult job. And as you say, Jill, I think it's mostly diplomacy plus craft, which can be really, really difficult as a role, but it's very rewarding when it kind of happens to come together.
I think of narrative design, of like design of being any time that you're working from the perspective of what does the player need to get the most out of this game in one way or another. So the skills that you're using to approach that problem could be anything. The design is in working around the user.
Yeah, and I often I've done a lot of this recently, but I often advocate for the player in that way in terms of like how we've labeled stuff. Like I've started to look very closely at the games I work on with UI labeling and what that says about our narrative to the player, because that's really neglected as a kind of storytelling method. And for example, even in Doom, they knew this because they named all the difficulty for Doom as stuff like, you know, hurt me plenty and stuff like that. That's like a real heavy metal themed difficulty menu, right? And I start to think a lot more these days about labeling and what it says to the player about the role that they play, and how much they'd want to click on something. If they saw a button labeled "Do not click me," they would want to click it.
I'm clicking that immediately.
Exactly. So there's a lot of stuff that I think that we don't think about with games where we can use it for narrative. And I start to try and like re-examine those if it's cheap to do so. And UI, stuff like text on UI is really cheap. You can replace it pretty much any part of the development cycle, as long as we haven't put out like videos, say, with the text in already. But it's just one of those things where, you know, you can change that and it's cheap, and why not use it as a way of saying to the player, this is part of your journey. So yeah, I've been re-examining that a little bit as well.
I think as a player, it's just so delicious when all the details come together.
Yeah, I think there's, what is it? Is it Nier that does that menu stuff? I don't know if any of you played it, but they play around with what the menu system means a lot, which is really interesting, I think.
It is interesting.
This is such a good discussion, but I want to jump back like 5 to 10 minutes. What are the red flags, if there are any, when you parachute in for a job? Like, if they tell you, can you change the story, but 90% of the VO has been recorded already, would you say yes or no?
I'd be like, I just run away screaming.
yeah, and it does happen. It's ludicrous that it does, but yeah, you genuinely do get gigs that are like that.
I don't think I've ever actually been in that much hot water. I think I've always been kind of okay, but yeah, that is a pretty dire situation. Have you done that, Rihanna?
No, I haven't, but I've heard of others like in myth and legend that have done that.
I brought that up because we had just heard about that for a AAA game last month.
Oh my god!
That exact thing that happened.
Yeah, those exact like percentages.
Oh god, that sounds terrible. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you would deal with that. I guess you look at what's there, and if you really needed the money, you would take the job and then look at what's there, and then figure out a way to, I don't know, take the existing characters and write something that makes sense for them. But I don't know. I mean, also, like, writing varies wildly and is often to do with the context it sits in. Like, I don't know any I don't think I know any game writers that are actually bad at game writing, as in like dialogue style. And I think that when games come out the other side and they're actually that feel badly written, it's not usually the writer's fault. It's the structure that has been designed for them, or the production that has kind of screwed up a bit, because it makes it then like a really difficult writing job, because that's the last thing you do. It's like right at the bottom of the pile. I don't know. That sounds like a really rough job to me.
We kind of touched about on this earlier, like 5 minutes ago, but I'd like to hear if anyone has more thoughts about it. What's the thing that you wish people understood more about the kind of work you do? Like either gamers or like even the people you work with.
I feel like I am a lot more a designer than I am a writer these days. And because people primarily know me for journalism, I think that they would assume the opposite. But I do, I think I would say 50%, at least maybe even 60 or 70% of my job is design. And maybe a very small amount of my job is diplomacy and meetings and leadership. And then the rest is writing. So there's not much left for writing. So I think that's the main thing I would say.
I think I've seen Jill talk about this on Twitter before. It's kind of understanding that, you know, a writer is not in control of kind of every facet of the game. I think players often see writers almost as directors in movies. So they're kind of in control of the entire narrative vision. And unless those writers actually have hard power on the team, i.e. they're creative directors or game directors, they're not going to have that kind of hard power. They're going to be working with a team. They're going to be, you know, fighting battles against other departments. They're going to be losing a lot of battles. And you can bet that every problem that occurs with the narrative in the game, there's some kind of writer who has shed blood and tears trying to make that be different. And, you know, I've certainly had cases where people have grumbled about things as if they were my fault, and it's just to do with level design or mechanics or something along those lines, which I have no control over whatsoever. But they see it as kind of part of the narrative, and they think that writers have a lot more hard power than actually we do. You know, certainly in a freelance capacity, and particularly on AAA games, you end up living around the edges of the games because you're trying to balance the kind of whims of a lot of different departments, a lot of different committees, of people who have an opinion on the story, all of which will probably contradict. And you're also trying to get a little bit of your own voice in there where you can. And that is particularly the bits where you kind of, you're living around the edges. So you always remember the favourite lines you have, because they're probably the ones you had to fight for, or you managed to slip by, you know, the committees of storytelling and things like that. So it's still pretty rough out there for game writers, even though the position is a lot more established now than it was, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah, and for me, like Kara, I really am a designer first and foremost. I went to school for stage design. I worked for 11 years as a web designer. I'm like primarily a tinkerer and maker of things. It happens that at one point I just became curious about whether I could write a novel. And I published two of them before going into games. And I just saw that writing was my most transferable skill. But the moment I activated that, games took it and went, "You're just a writer. You're not a real designer. You're just someone who wants to shove novels into games." I feel like it's been like, I love my career. I love games. I love working in games. But I also feel like it's kind of been like a 7-year battle to get myself re-recognized as what I actually am, which is a designer. And I get to do a lot more design work on my current project. It's making me very happy.
Yeah, I mean, I think people would be really, really surprised at how little writing I did. And it's not because I'm lazy. It's mostly because I have to persuade people to make a container for my writing first. And then I have to also go about making prototypes for that container myself. So, I mean, I think half of the battle is proving that it can be done. And then you spend the rest of the time kind of trying to negotiate like how long maybe like a piece of VO can go on for, or how many lines you can fit into something, and that's the rest of it. But yeah, I think people would be really surprised how little time I actually spend writing. I spend so little time writing these days, actually, that I actively have to pursue personal projects outside of games writing, simply because I'm scared that my writing skill will get rusty. So I start to write other stuff like comics on the side. So yeah, like I think everyone would be quite surprised at how demanding the design skills are in some of these roles, at least.
I have no segue for this question, but since you've all worked in AAA, are there any skills you need to have for working there that are unique to AAA?
Patience.
Yeah, a lot of patience.
Resilience. A lot of resilience.
Yeah, you have to have an ego. I would say you have to have an ego. An ego that's resilient enough that it can take everyone hating you all of the time, every single line that you write. Everyone is going to hate something you have written at some point. Almost everyone is going to hate what you do at some point because it doesn't cater to what they think the game is. And that's like, sometimes that can be like 200 people who all have expectations for what the game means to them. And at some point you're going to be wrong to them and you will have to deal with that.
There are a lot of different modes of creative collaboration. And the one that I have found to predominate in AAA games is aggressive.
Yelling.
There's like this idea that the best idea is going to destroy the other ones in a fist fight. And so if your idea is any good, then you'll be able to fight for it. And it's always fighting, fighting, fighting. And I think it changes you to always work like that.
Yeah, it can be very tiring to experience aggression against your work constantly. And that can be just the way that AAA thinks it should work.
To summon an equal amount of aggression to be able to stay in the ring is just exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, again, because I work at MM and we have 40% women, it's not so common to experience anyone being aggressive towards anyone. So that can be very, very that's relaxing.
Nice. That's the dream.
Yeah, it's just the time pressure that happens, which is normal. But I don't know. I think having dabbled in and out of AAA, I think that Rihanna's right. You need to have the ability to be extremely patient because things take so long to even like from the concept stage to being made to then the game designers have to make it freaking work. And the part where they make it work can be like a part that lasts until 2 weeks before ship. And then you have to write the goddamn thing and you're like panicking. So yeah, it can certainly be a difficult job. I would say diplomacy is your main ally, I guess, in AAA.
When you have people constantly tell you that your work is not good, how do you deal with that when it's a constant thing? Because I would like to think that Max and I could last that for a while, but after a certain amount, it's just like, maybe they're right. Maybe I shouldn't be here.
I think trying to contextualize it is good. So if you look at the other parts of the game and whether they're telling a story effectively, and they're usually parts of the game that you don't make yourself. If you ask yourself, do those parts of the game effectively tell any story that I recognize, and the answer is no, then how could you possibly compensate for that with three lines of dialogue? I think you just have to look at it contextually and say, am I really shitty, or is this an impossible job where I have been put in an impossible position to make this sound good? And a lot of the time the answer will be no. But it's also part of your job to take responsibility for telling people how they could help you to make it good and to try to explain to them that maybe if we did these things, then maybe it would raise it up and elevate it so the player felt like they were involved. So I think actually I've learned to try to not beat myself up too much about this sort of stuff. But yeah, it can be incredibly tough on your ego. I also ask friends who are games writers if they think my work is shitty. And most of the time, their answer is no. Some of the time, they're like, well, you could improve these things. But I mean, most of the time, it's no. So you can reassure yourself with that kind of mentorship or friendship where there's like, they know the craft and they can reassure you that it is fine.
I always end up developing a kind of active mental model of the studio politics. And then I can kind of ask myself, is this person who is giving me a hard time, do they actually dislike my work, or is it somehow in their advantage to have me silenced?
Oh, yeah.
And then I can work on the real problem, which is not the work at all, but it's acknowledging sort of the tense social conditions under which a lot of people are laboring. Because sometimes in AAA, like the path to advancement can be really murky for some jobs, and that can motivate people to almost abandon their creative work in favor of kind of like full-time electioneering, depending on what kind of studio it is. So you kind of have to be mindful of that and of the way that it can twist people's perceptions and actions.
Yeah, or maybe like it's misdirected anger, right? Like it's more like they feel like they're under pressure and they need someone to yell at.
Yeah, or they are not, like a lot of times people are not appreciated, and then that makes them act in unappreciative ways.
Right.
It's just kind of like a cycle.
Yeah.
And being aware of that can help you, if not survive it, then figure out what to do instead on the next job.
Is it important to be aware of studio politics when working in AAA?
Yeah.
Yeah, really important, I would say. Because I think, especially when you're a narrative designer, I think you need some allies in the director's kind of level, because what you do is so high level that you can't try to write for a game and not know exactly what the directors want out of their game. You have to know all the time what they want and try to make them happy with their decisions, and try to like funnel at least some of what they want from those decisions into your work. Obviously, they should be supplying you with all of the material you need to make the story great. But if that's not the case, then you need to at least understand what it is that they want to get out of the game. Sometimes that's totally different from what you think that the game should be. But if you want to survive it, you have to really know what they want from their work.
I'm going to switch gears. Making a mistake or failing at something with your writing can often be more helpful with improving your skills than learning that lesson in a book or online or whatever, because it's more personal and you saw where things went wrong. So what writing mistakes or failures have you learned the most from that you can talk about?
Wow, failures?
I've got a good one. It's not from games, though. My first unpublished novel, I kind of rewrote 9 times. And when I first sent it out for publication, I got kind of an okay reception. But, I managed to get an agent with it. And then when she started sending it out to her much better contacts, the feedback that she got back in return was that they loved the writing and hated the story, which is like very confusing feedback. But I worked a lot with that agent on plot, and like we discovered, she's like, I reread it, and what I discovered is that like you can write for a really long time with no actual story and no one will notice, like the pages turn. But then as soon as you do notice, you feel incredibly let down. Like, why did I put in all that time? So the thing I've worked the hardest on is like learning how to plot and structure and not just like write out of the love of the sound of how people speak and like from one joke to the next, or just out of the love of describing things.
I think for me, most of the ways that the stories that I've worked on in games tend to, when they take a left turn or something, or like they're not as amazing as they could have been, I think it's always because I was not in-house or not in the office. I know that sounds really self-aggrandizing, but it's like I really feel like when people have to fill in what they think you meant or have to try to adapt after the gameplay has changed in some way, that's when things start to go wrong. When you're not in the office, things go wrong. Like, shit will go on fire, and then people will put it out in a way that just doesn't make sense for the story, and it will just go wrong.
For AAA especially, I like to be there in the middle of the floor working, but also hearing everything that's going on around me so I can deal with it the second it arises when I hear things start to take those weird turns.
I need to know, I not only need to know what the problems with the story are and the problems with the gameplay are, but I need to know everyone's problems all the time. I need to be fixing everyone's problems all the time, because if I'm not, then my job is made so much more difficult. And I think I've learned it the hard way that I can't just be out of the office and do it remotely. A lot of the time things change and no one ever tells you, and you come back in and you're like, what the heck has happened? This is not the way this can happen. So yeah, I think that's one of the things I've definitely learned.
Rihanna, did you have any helpful failures?
I think it's actually somewhat being kind to yourself in terms of not getting too stressed about how, you know, not everything being perfect the first time, and allowing yourself to fail and giving yourself the time to fail and make things better. And that can be so often something you don't get in the writing process in games, which is time to fail, time to iterate on the script. And you know that I do a lot of it now. You know, with the film stuff, I have to iterate a lot on the script, and there's always kind of drafts and there's always revisions. And so I have learned to iterate, you know, quite quickly and hone in on the problems, and also, you know, see comfort from things getting better with every draft, and that it just takes time and noodling on things. And, you know, you have to be okay with failing and then like going back and then doing it better. And it's not, and I think it's a lot about not panicking at not getting it perfect, and just know that, you know, you're with time and focus, you will be able to get it nearer to what you want, at least.
And since we're at the end of the year, how do all of you feel about the state of the industry right now?
The state of the industry? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
The entire industry.
Yeah.
It seems, I don't know. I feel like I've been in a bunker for years. I've just been working on Dreams. I think a world in which Dreams is released would be a good world. I don't know what else to say. I heard actually that we just got a UK Game Workers Union. Isn't that good?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's
really cool.
You can now join a union. So that is a good state of the industry, or becoming a better state of the industry, I think. That's really good. I think maybe sometime in the next couple of years we might see one happen in America. We'll see how that goes.
I'm also excited about Game Workers Unite and the amount of discussion and progress that has been generated in the last year. I think this is really interesting and is going to be good for the industry, whatever form it ends up taking. And one nice thing is, like, when I'm in indie, I feel much more free to discuss these things, which I guess I've only just recently noticed. I feel much more cautious about how I speak while I'm working in AAA. And that's one thing I don't like very much. It's a reason I prefer to be in indie.
Yeah, it can feel very constrained, I guess. But I think it's also just like across the board, it feels like you have to protect your colleagues from their work ever being assessed unfairly. I guess. I don't know. There's part of it that is like, is I don't know, some kind of empathetic blanket. But yeah, I think the general state of the industry has improved a lot with the involvement of women in recent years. Like, I think our visibility has increased. I think that our determination to be heard and to make a difference has increased. I think also we have started to talk to each other more. All of these things are much better than I think that they were. Of course, I don't really know too much. I don't know if I've ever really spoken to like people like Brenda Laurel about this, but certainly I feel like we're making headway somewhere, but I don't know how much or whether it's even going to make a difference.
Sometimes people ask me, are things changing? And I just feel like that's too passive a way of phrasing the question. And I'll try to answer something more like, yes, I know people who are working to make changes. Like I can see when specific people's efforts come to fruition, like you can see measurable results, but I don't think there is such a thing as it's just changing. It's a collection of people like making the effort to make the changes. I actually find that very heartening.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I'm so grateful for people who have been there and done the stuff before me. You know, like you and Rihanna, because you talk to me, just talk to me, like that makes me feel a lot more supported than if I never knew of your existence or was able to like contact you in any way. And I think that in itself is something that maybe before was missing. I guess maybe when you started out, maybe you didn't feel like you had that kind of support.
Yeah, and it's kind of one of the things I've been talking about a little bit more openly, in that there wasn't really, I never knew anyone else doing what I was doing. I as a journalist, I was never introduced to a me. Like no one sat down and said, this is our writer, or even this is our, you know, so-and-so is a designer who also does our writing. Like no one really talked about it at all. Like it was being done, but it was seen as the sort of secondary skill set that wasn't really talked about. And so I kind of forged ahead and sort of cut through the narrative wilderness with my own machete, with no kind of mentor beside me, because I was often the only one working on a team. So I had to learn and fail on the job with often no one on the team that even cared about narrative that much. So it was kind of lonely, and I do envy younger writers coming up, because they will have mentors and they will have writer teams to work with. They will get to work in writers' rooms, which is something I didn't get. And I'm probably getting more of that now working in other mediums that I didn't kind of get in games. Like I learnt on the battlefield very much where the metal meets the meat. It was a bit lonely, I guess, and that is something that I'm very glad is changing, and I think it's very important for writers coming up in the industry, particularly young women as well.
Since we're getting right at the end of it, I think we'll do one last question and just do one about process. I think we've only done one this entire podcast. What do all of you think are the keys to doing world building well? Like, how much should you have figured out before you start writing a story?
Well, I certainly like to like have all of the main players in the room, anyone who's got a stake in the story in the game. It's nice to have everyone in the room to argue about what they think is important to them. And that's the basis that you could do a lot of world building from. I don't know about anyone else, but that's kind of what I like. I like to know what other people want from the world first.
Yeah, and I don't think it's like world building is separate from making the story. You find things you need out of the world from the story, and vice versa. So it needs to be kind of flexible and go back and forth usually.
It kind of develops as the game goes on. And some decisions that the art department, for example, will make for you, like they'll really fire your imagination. Like you'll just start to be like, like really overwhelmed with like love for the art team who've done this like one mad decision that's like basically opened up a whole other world of possibilities for you and has done a lot of world building for you. That will happen like more times than you can say, especially in AAA, where like people are so specialized and they'll like take an idea you threw out in one meeting and then expand it to like the reaches of their imagination, and you're like, oh my god, I can't believe how beautiful this is. I mean, that's certainly what's happened on Dreams, is that because everyone at MM is so specialized and so talented. Like, they'll just make something, and every day I'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe that the world that we exist in is this one. It's so cool. So yeah, like a lot of the smaller decisions that your team makes or presents from their department, you'll end up incorporating those into the overall narrative. You will have like a kind of skeleton, but it's not, I don't know if it's important to like hash everything out in the beginning. I think it just, it's like an ongoing, like you said, it's a process thing. I don't know.
Would you agree, Rihanna?
I mean, I've always done it kind of, done a little bit to kind of get myself going, but I feel that some of the world building is just done on the page as well, and so you have to kind of leave room for that. I don't like to do all the world building beforehand before I start doing scenes and things like that. I like to do a fair amount and then kind of add stuff as I go along. And yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. And working closely with the designers has been very helpful for me. On things like Overlord, I'd say, interestingly, Overlord's the game that I enjoyed the most because I worked so closely with the designers, because it was a smaller team, because it kind of allowed me to help shape the story through the world building, and because I was allowed to be co-director on the voice acting on the first game, and I directed and cast it on the second. And like, I never get that opportunity elsewhere, particularly not in AAA. There's always loads of levels of people between me and the people that will have to make, you know, my script work in a game. And yeah, it's that, I think when you're, it's so important to be, for writers to be embedded with the narrative so they can kind of do this world building, and so they can embolden the designers to be part of that, and show that, you know, I believe every facet of a game's development contributes to the story in some way, whether it's art, animation, music, you know, level design, mechanics, it all supports and underpins the story. So you need to get everyone on board, really, if you can, or as many people on board, and I think we touched upon this, to support the story in the best way. And that's much easier to do if you're a writer who's a creative director or a game director. But I think it's easier to, if you're not, it's easier to do in smaller teams.
Yeah, I mean, do either of you ever, do people give you storyboards of like scenes you've drawn up, for example? Or like, I always find that really exciting, like the part of the process where someone sends you a storyboard and like, oh my God, it exists. It's so cool.
Yeah, for Shadow of the Tomb Raider, we had a really rigorous storyboarding process because our, I can't remember his exact title, the guy in charge of cinematic things, he came out of DreamWorks in animation, and animation is all storyboarding.
Right.
So it was really interesting to learn how to work that way. And it also meant that by the time we made it to performance capture, we knew exactly what we wanted. And also that meant that, like, when if anything changed in the studio because of the way an actor was comfortable performing it, we knew exactly what we could tell them, like, yeah, you can do that, or sort of you can do that, but we need you to keep this in mind. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Because I never really think about bodies and how they move through a space. I always just know that they move and that's it. And I always think it's really amazing seeing, like, maybe the, like, blocking or staging of how your scenes might work. Like, those are just, like, I don't know how artists can think in space in the way that they do. And I don't know. And I think as well, like, it's made my skills better in terms of writing scenes, because I never really thought about that before. But now I'm like, oh, I should stand up and see how it is to move from A to B.
I don't have a film background, so I have like theater and other stuff. So I have just a completely different way of looking at narratives and spaces than the film guys did.
I mean, to be honest with you, like, I think it's better to have a theatrical background because things are more like theater in the round than,
yeah, I agree with that.
Film, yeah.
Yeah. For most games, when you have like a linear plot and things are going to be shot like a film, then sure, bring film into it.
Yeah, like I have a friend at Pixar, Michael Fredrickson. And he always asks me how on earth it is that we tell stories in games in that 3D space, because at Pixar, they can basically plan out their camera angles beforehand and then arrange the scene to look the best at those angles. And he's like, that's how we do it. How could you possibly do any storytelling without that setup? With the camera all over the place, how do you make everything look good? And I'm like, I have no idea. Like, I don't know if it's magic to me.
I think that's the question we're always answering with every game.
Yeah. How is it possible to do any of this? It isn't.
How is any
Let's
of
never
this?
Put the game
what?
And that's a good note to end this on. So we'll go with how can people find each of you on the internet and start with Rihanna?
Twitter is at Ree Pratchett. RihannaPratchett.com, but the contact page is go to my agent, which will reach me. But yeah, Twitter, and I'm on Facebook as well, so I'm fairly easy to find.
Great. Jill?
On Twitter, I'm disco, like the dance, _Jill. And then from there, you can find my website and Instagram.
And Kara?
Probably it's best to find me on Facebook at Kara Ellison. I have a public page there. I deleted my Twitter, but I guess because of Void Bastards, I kind of snuck back on there a little bit, which is just Kara Ellison, all one word. But probably the best way to reach me is through my website, which is at karaellison.co.uk. If you want to talk to me, my contact's on there.
You can find this podcast on ScriptLawCast on Twitter. Our logo was done by Lily Nishida at Lily Nishida on Twitter, and our music was done by Tumelo at Tumelo Makes on Twitter. And that's everything. So thank you all for coming on and talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.